A word from the wise. It's all just smoke. I've seen it all. What's happened before will happen again, time and time again. This is the conclusion I've reached. From a life spent searching, experimenting, learning and doing, I could fill a book with all my thoughts, all my advice. Advice from a life lived fast and lived hard. In a world with so much smoke, I denied myself nothing. It's all vanity. And the conclusion is this. Fear God. Follow His commands. For He is the true teacher. Wisdom. I just didn't know it at first.
I know there are more lights. have you ever felt like your life was a novel that was kind of poorly written? We made it. So here we are at the end of Ecclesiastes. We're in the 12th chapter. I've been invited to hang around through the end of August. So I'm going to do a short series on the Spirit of God and how to walk in the Spirit. And appreciate your prayers about that. I think it'll be fun. As I was preparing for this final message, this last piece of Ecclesiastes where the story really comes together, I was reminded of almost like a descriptor of how life goes. I was thinking about this, and it's the story of a guy who, this is my neck of the woods, you know, Mississippi, Alabama, and so they're going hunting, and he's taking a buddy with him, and he says, I got to stop and tell the guy who owns the land that we're going to be hunting just so he knows, doesn't hear something, wonder. So he's been hunting there for 20 years, and he stops in and says hi to his buddy. He said, we're going to hunt down here. I said, no problem at all, but would you do me a favor? My old mule's sick. It's dying, and I love that mule, and I just can't bring myself to, you know, put it out of its misery. Would you do it for me? He said, be glad to. So he gets a little impish, and he decides, hey, I'll pull a joke on my friend. Gets in the car, says, that guy, after 20 years, will not let us hunt. I am so mad. He complained all the way down the road. I'm so mad, I'm going to shoot his prize mule. Hops out, gets his gun, boom. And then he hears, boom, boom, and looks back, and the other guy said, I got two of his cows, too. Now, see, like, life kind of goes that way sometimes. You know, you got really nice intentions, and then what? You know, Jody and I, we wanted to get married, so we did. That was great. And we enjoyed our little life. And then we said, why don't we have a kid? And that was fine. And then we wound up having five of them. And let me just tell you, here's the secret. Okay, basically what I've noticed is people will have one less child than they plan. So if you plan for two, you'll probably have one, three, two. See how that goes? Most people that have three, you ask them, they say, yeah, we thought about four. Just watch this. Jody had a different philosophy, which was, let's take them one at a time. And next thing we knew, we had five at one at a time. And I had this true existential crisis because I suddenly realized you cannot go on vacation in one vehicle with five children unless it's an institutional van. So we didn't want to do that, and life worked out. But life is that way, and it's running along in this process, and we're making choices, and some of them work and some of them don't, and some of them surprise us. And I really think the thing for us to do now to really put Ecclesiastes together is I want to use the word remember. I want to talk about our memory. The word itself, I have a little background in memory. as I mentioned earlier this morning, I put myself through college partly teaching people mnemonics and how to memorize things. In fact, my memory is so good, I can remember things that didn't even happen. It's amazing. And Jody's memory, not so great. And she had confessed that. This isn't a diss on her. In fact, it's really kind of cool because it's like every morning, my jokes are fresh to her, right? That's pretty cool, isn't it? And she can't hold a grudge at all about anything. Me, I hold grudges I shouldn't even have. I hold them for you because I remember what they did, but not Jody. Well, look, here's what memory is. The best, I mean, they'll change the theory next week, but the best I understand it now, it's the old idea is memories are put different places like in your brain, or they're, you know, ruts or grooves and you get habits and all. Really, it's not that picture so much as the different elements are scattered and the brain recreates the memory. So it's like, you know, you have an alphabet and you put together a word, you know, Diffenbachia, right? That's a plant. So you just put that word together. And that's what memories are doing. And the word remember is nice that way in English because it's re, Latin, back again, right? And member, the members. So we're putting all the members back together again. That's the picture. And I was thinking about this, about memory and remembering things. I was thinking about my life and running back through my life about what exactly do I recall. Some people don't recall much about their childhood. Commonly, it's because there were not good things in it, so you didn't review it. And so review is a part of the story, right? Well, I was going back through, and I was thinking about 1/4 of July. And we had, I was probably four, I guess. And if you probably can't see this, but I have a dimple, but it's a dent that I'm going to tell you how I acquired that. I have a number of these. I have this sliver off from trying to cut a hair with a fillet knife. That was really smart. This was a fight over a wax whistle at football where a broken Coke bottle severed several arteries. That was my wood carving merit badge is right there. So anyway, I have just, all this little story, little reminders. Well, I was sitting there thinking about this 4th of July event, and what happened was there was a box. I remember it was Halloween costumes. It was like a Frankenstein and a Dracula and probably a werewolf, you know, something like that. And I don't know where we'd gotten it been given, but I'd happened to notice that there were some cherry bombs. Do they still make those? So cherry bombs, they'd like float and they explode, like a M80 or a M whatever's beyond that. I mean, back off that a little bit. But it's an explosive firecracker, okay? This is something not to try at home. You can only try it in my childhood. And I'm sitting there, and I watch all these fireworks go off, and it's all fun, and stuff's all over the place, and they're old expended matchbooks and everything. And I decide to go get one of those cherry bombs and light it. And so I went up the street, not in front of my house, and I put the cherry bomb down about that far away from me. And I found some matches, and I struggled with them and got one lit. And I lit it, and I just watched that thing. And it just blew up right in my face. And I went home, and I told my parents some cockamamie story that had nothing to do with the cherry bomb, because I intuited that would not be a good thing. I think of Dad. Jody and I were talking about this. My dad, for some time when we were little, we had a ping pong table, and my brother and dad would play ping pong. I didn't. I remember watching, kind of. But dad one time pulled his pajamas up high, and I declared that his ping pong pajamas, and that became a family thing, you know. We say all these fun things. We had one child one time. We called him by his name. He said, "That's not my name. My name's Cuckoo Baby." So we still call him Cuckoo Baby, you know, even though he is not. On a different note and thinking through the memories around 7th, 8th grade, I was at our football game. I wasn't playing. It was high school. I was in junior high or whatever. And the cheerleaders were down there cheering. And a bunch of us boys started throwing ice at the cheerleaders. Thought that would be a good thing to do. And so we're up on this. It's a higher level, and it's like concrete stadium. And we're throwing down at the cute little cheerleaders, throwing a little ice at them. And they're cheering and dodging, you know. And I reached in, and you know those old Coke cups and the ice, sometimes it'll freeze together. And so I pulled out like a small glacier, right? And in one of those strange moments, like my hole-in-one in 1986, Keaton Park, south of Dallas, Texas, the eighth hole with an 8-iron on July the 8th, it was the weirdest thing. After my friend told me the worst 7 holes of golf he's ever seen, I hit a perfect shot. Lands 10 feet, goes straight in, 145 downhill, witnesses everything. My hole in one, and that's why I quit golf, because, you know, once you master something, it's like. So I threw this ice, and in the same way, right when I threw it, you just knew. This small glacier was headed to my friend, Teresa Cheatham. You can wiki Teresa Cheatham and find out that she was the runner-up to Miss America in 1979. I hit her with ice and cut her eye, bleeding down her face, a few years before that. Would she have won if I had not done that? I have to live with that. Ecclesiastes, what do we remember of this book? Let's go back and remember it. Go back to chapter 1 if you just want to thumb through or listen along. The words of the preacher, the son of David, the king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of all is vanity, the cycles. Remember that? And no matter what you do good things, you do bad things, you do wise things, poor things. Time and chance happen to them all, and this is this theme picking up, and this vain life in which we have, these cycles, they go around again and again and again. He's laying this piece of wisdom out. He's inviting us to understand with him, who had all this money and time and resource, to think it through and discover what was up, as it were, with how to live a decent life, how to live a good life, how to have a life of well-being. Calls it a striving after the wind. In chapter 2, if you remember, Solomon gets a little more distressed about it. And he comes to the place of saying that he even hated life there in about verse 17. He's unfolding the story, and he's telling us that he's making sense of this, that it doesn't add up, and it's awful. But he keeps learning. He keeps writing. He talks about hating toil, nothing better that he should do, eat, drink. And in this struggle, he starts unfolding some things. Chapter 3 talks about time. There's a time for everything, right? War and peace, and to be born and to die, to kill, to heal, to mourn, to dance. There's a time. And in understanding the nature of that time, that we have a task. He says things like, he's made everything beautiful in his time. Also, he's put eternity in a man's heart, yet so that he can't find out what God has for him afterwards. So there's this thing in us that wants to know and focus on this life to come. And yet, we don't know what it's like. Now, this message should be theoretically about that, but I'm going to stick to Ecclesiastes, this life under the sun theme. I will tell you, though, heaven is going to be awesome, okay? It'll be great. Your retirement program, free dental forever. No deductible. And no real need. Your teeth will be perfect. I have this theory that you get a new body, right? When we die, we really don't die, we just kind of lose our body. Isn't that right? We pass on to this next life, presence of the Lord. Well, and then we get a new body, and I've got this idea that this new body, all of our bodies are exactly the same height. But you feel taller than everyone else. I'm thinking, there, I'm going for that. Chapter 4, he returns to the conversation about evil. Today's theme is really about the will of God, and this unfolding of this book is about the will of God. And the question I'm wanting to ask you is, what does God want you to do that you haven't? What does God want you to do that you haven't? I told Jody, I said, I know the grammar's not right, but that sounds good. And then she spent time working on other grammar. Gave me several options, but we're not doing it. What does God want you to do that you haven't? I want you to hold that as we remember this book, right? Chapter 5 shows up and it discusses about, the temple, the nature of God's people. There's relational stuff in here. You get the later part of 5 and he's talking about the incredible nature of finding work that you enjoy doing. And the nature of finding that work allows you not to spend time regretting the past because you're engaged in this work. He spends time speaking there again of eating and drinking and finding the ability to have stuff and enjoy it as a gift of God in the midst of this vain existence. He asserts in chapter 6 things like, if you consider the work of God, who can make straight what he's made crooked? You can't fight this game. You can be irritated by it or you can play along with it. But in this vain context of this life down here, he starts saying wisdom's the way to go. Doesn't always work out that way, but that's how you bet. And it's an unfolding of this wisdom of Solomon. And he hints at the importance of fearing God. He hints at the importance of how God relates to this story. He talks about kings in chapter 8, fearing their command. Talking about how this orientation of thinking about God changes us and makes us into better individuals. In 9, he hints about how death comes to us all. Therefore, knowing this, how do we think about this life, this short, vain life that we have? Get to 10, and it's further a series of pithy, wise, almost a series of gunshots of wisdom about how it works in relationships and quarreling and conflict and making our own talents refined and effective in this world, a theme of growth and maturation, of some impact, always oriented toward God, other people, and our own personal well-being fulfillment. 11, we just looked at cause and effect, casting bread on the water comes back. You sow in the morning, sow in the evening, you keep doing different things, you don't know what works. More wisdom, right? And then he gets to 12. And in 12, we're asking, what does God want you to do that you haven't, right? I want to start in chapter 12, verse 1. It says, remember also your creator in the days of your youth. Remember your creator. It's actually Hebrew. It's in the plural. It kind of carries this flavor of greatness and majesty, the way the commentators, language guys talk about it. We know this kind of plurality with the Trinity. We also know when we talk about how our parents affected us. You know, parents, plural, but the two individuals in combination, these things were united. You know, in our home, Jody's aspiration to be the leading lover and me to try to be the loving leader. And the way this leadership and love complement worked with our kids, with our family, with our home. Remember your creator. Remember. Put it back together. Remember this God, this great majestic being that made you, and he made you for something, right? What does God want you to do that you haven't? Let's hold that. What this gets to is learning, and I'm going to skip ahead and then go back. If you look over at verse 9, besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. Now, what he just told us is about learning. The process is this. You ponder and you search and you arrange. It says here, weighing and studying. Translations vary, but they're at these same ideas. You are pondering. You're weighing it. You're studying or searching. You're arranging many proverbs here, he says, with great care. This theme of learning in life is, I think, where the real action is. This is the challenge we have. If we're not perfect, right? People that think they're perfect don't learn anything. Just ask them. You know, there's nothing to learn. But the rest of us who have not quite gotten there might want something, and we know where we are, and so what we have to do is learn. And the way you go about do that is exactly what Solomon says, this weighing, studying, arranging. You're weighing things, you're studying them, and then you're putting them in an order to make sense. So I was thinking about this and the various things I've learned in my life. What came to mind was yesterday afternoon, I'm sitting out in the beautiful, glorious, sweltering northeast San Antonio backyard watching my buntings show up, this very beautiful, brightly colored bird that shows up. So I'm hanging out back and I'm reading this and I'm sweating to the oldies. And I sit there and I look over, and one of the things that heat seems to generate in our part of the world, because we're next to a 1,600-acre ranch, is flies, okay? So I looked over at that fly, and I did this, and let it go, and it flew. I caught it in the air. Now, I'm 50 years old, and I should not be able to do that, right? But I know how to catch flies. Now, I grew up in Alabama. That's not a complete explanation, okay? But what happened was, Steve Traylor and I, we were in Boy Scouts, and it was a hot summer. And we decided to figure out how to catch flies. And I'll tell you the whole secret. It's really easy. All you have to do is close your hand. Now, by the way, I was doing it left-handed and backwards. Did you notice that? So it's just a thing. Everybody needs a talent to, you know, maybe Simon Cowell will see me someday. Woo! Which hand? So I studied this. Steve and I studied it, and we started noticing things. All you have to do is catch a fly is close your hand completely around where the fly is going to be when you close your hand. That's all it takes, okay? So as we studied flies, that's kind of a, you know, ninja or Jedi trick right there, but we studied flies and we noticed, okay, so when they sit for a minute, they'll start rubbing their hands. See? Now they're off balance. That's like, you know, an entire third of their stabilizing balance system is gone right there. And then we started noticing if you attack them from behind, maybe they can't see as well, right? So that was a part of the theory, you know? And we studied and we pondered, see how that goes? And we started raising the sequence. And we noticed they kind of went down before they went up. And so that affected us, and we noticed kind of a range where they'd go, and we realized if they're trapped on a table or something, not just at the edge, they can't go down. They have to come back up. And so we started playing with the range out here. I know you parents are going to love this. All your children are going to go, I want to learn to catch flies like Pastor Fred does, you know. So sorry about that. But that's how you learn something, even as mundane as flies, right? And then we learned to wash our hands so we wouldn't get tuberculosis. Solomon is sitting here in a more profound way saying, besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge. You know, preachers, wise people, kings, prophets, all these folks don't have to always teach. A wise person can just keep it to himself, but Solomon goes the extra mile and says specifically, and he taught them, and he weighed and he studied and arranged many proverbs with great care. And the preacher sought to find words of delight, uprightly wrote words of truth. And that's what he was doing. He's trying to find the way to say it, find it put together, way. Gave us all those proverbs we have. He gave us this literature. It's wisdom. And it's described, according to him, in the next verse as the words of the wise are like goads. Do you know what a goad is? So a goad, it can be a nail or a spike or a piece of metal or a piece of stone or whatever, but you kind of poke a ox with it in the hip, make it move, you know, or goat or what are you, any kind of animal. Paul in chapter 26 of Acts, the Lord says to Paul, says, you know, how long are you going to kick against the goat? like, stop it, stop it. The Lord is working on him, and Paul's trying to go, stop it. That's what goad is about. And that's what the word of God, a proverb, a truth, can come in and just goad us, push us along, grab us, right? Used to say, I stick the sword of the Spirit in. It's up to God whether it hurts or not. That's what I'm trying to do, right? The words of the wise are like goads, and like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. They are given by one shepherd, and the idea is that God himself is overseeing this thing, but these nails are nailed down. They could be temple gold nails or just the normal ones used in door frames. They had them then, and these nails hit it. You know, a professor used to say, and so-and-so hit the nail with his head when he said blah, 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 you know? And that's the idea. It is a pointed thing that hits you just right, goad, nail, puts it in your brain in a way that you don't quite ever forget it. My son, beware of anything beyond these. Of making many books, there's an end in much study and weariness to the flesh. And what he's talking about is you can study and study and read and read and read and study and read and read. But sometimes you don't need that. You just need the truth. I've had people, Jody and I've worked with couples and in both parenting and in couple relationship issues, marriage type things. And working with people, many times I've had to say, you need to quit reading books. In fact, I've actually, most of the time when I do coaching, I make it clear they have to drop all their other counseling or coaching relationships because I just can't battle with that many ideas. Because most of it, we need to get down to one thing. You know, like parenting. I mean, honestly, if you want to see a behavior in a child, what you do is you figure out what you want the behavior to be, and then you look at what behavior they're doing, right? So you see those don't match. If they match, we need to pick something else. So you look at that, and then you go, okay, so the game is, if you do the behavior I don't want, there's going to be some kind of consequence, and if you do the behavior I do want, there's going to be like a good consequence, right? That's kind of what you need. And what we do, as I've mentioned before, is overcomplexificate the whole thing, don't we? And we turn it all kinds of stuff. Well, he got his hair cut and it made him feel bad. And how would you feel if you didn't get a pet snake when you wanted one? You're in second grade. I would have felt glad I could catch flies. You know, that's how I grew up. We can study and look and work at it and miss out on wisdom. And that's Solomon's point. There are three things to remember. That's all we need today. Three things. Three things we want to remember toward what does God want you to do that you haven't. And they work like this. You go back to chapter 12, verse 1. And the first thing is to remember your Creator in context. And the context is a divide in your life between youth and old age. And the way the Bible is talking about it, we're going to see it, is the divide is youth, and I'd call it old age, okay? Not old age. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth before the evil days come and the years draw near of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. This week I was with a friend and he's older and having a number of medical issues and it was kind of tough to visit. We hadn't visited in a long time and catch up and just the number of things that were discouraging to him. They really were. And at one point, I finally got my glass of water and his glass of water, and I toasted, and I said, yeah, but we got one good moment here, don't we? And he laughed. Because we lose this perspective sometimes, and that's what it's looking at. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth. That's the time to do it. Remember. We are told we can have pleasure all of our life, but there's this coming day of difficulty. He says, before the sun, the light, and the moon, and the stars are darkened, and the clouds return after the rain. All these analogies in here there's debate about, but roughly we all get the idea. It's not good, but it's coming. And remembering your Creator in the context of youth and this coming time allows you to live in a fresh, live way. When it says here, this moon, stars, darken, clouds return after the rain, there's a darkening that goes on in our life as we age. From 20 to 40, you can receive half the light into your eyes. 40 to 60, half again. Have you ever noticed how adults come in and say, hey, turn some lights on so you can read? They're doing that because they couldn't read in that light. You're fine. It says here, in the day when the keepers of the house tremble. What are the keepers of the house? It's looking at our arms. They keep in a defense way too, and they can keep up things. They act, that's what he calls them. He says, and the strong men are bent. What are the strong men that are bent? It's these legs. And as we get older, they bend, they buckle. What's the saying? Our legs buckle and our belt won't. Something like that. The grinders cease because they're few. Your teeth go away. And don't get me wrong, we got technology. We can straighten legs, put in knees, put in fake teeth, all week toupees. We can do it all, you know, but it's still going to happen. And those who look through the windows are dimmed. The eyes again, and the doors and the streets are shut. Some debate about what they mean with that. But it's a closing off of your life, I think. There's a moving internally, a quieting. The sound of the grinding is low. This context, probably the grinding at the will or work of young people, and you don't hear it as well. One rises up at the sound of a bird, and all the daughters of song are brought low. And that's what happens. You start as you age, you sleep less, right? You get up, that's a little noise. I've done this since I was 5. Never didn't go to sleep anyway, so this won't be new to me. This will all be, oh, I've been old for my whole life. In fact, I figured out Jody will go to sleep about an hour before me, get up an hour after. You do the math, about 2 hours a day that I'm awake more than her. You add that up, and it's like I'm awake a month every year longer than she is. That's just crazy, you know? And then I realized, golly, that'd be a pretty nice break to not have to hear myself talk for a month, a year. And then I was a little jealous of the whole thing. They're afraid of what's high. They are. And if they're not, they should be. I was at a funeral a few weeks ago, and I saw this lady used to be in my old church. One of my parishioners, friend, and I saw Sally, and I said, how you doing? I saw her, and she broke down crying when she saw me, just broke down. Bleh! And I thought, I didn't even know you knew this guy this well, but it really wasn't that. I said, what's wrong? She said, Jim fell off the roof this week. I said, is he hurt? She said, yeah. She said, he slid off the roof and hit the car, landed on the car. I went, is the car okay? I'm not very good at encouragement, you know, but she laughed and said, that's what Jim said, which I knew is probably what he did say. That's why I said it. What are you doing on the roof when you're much, 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 much older than me? Most of us start catching on. We're afraid of heights. That becomes a part of the problem. We're afraid of falling, right? There are terrors in the way. There are dangers out there. The almond tree blossoms. That's talking about the white bloom. Your hair turns white, gray, right? Grasshopper drags itself along. What's that talking about? Late fall, they start dying. Have you ever studied grasshoppers? I have, since I studied flies. Why not? And then they do. They just drag along. And that's the picture of us. We age. Haven't you noticed that? We drag along. It gets tougher on us just to move. And desire fails. Some commentators say that's romantic desire. I'm pretty sure it's all desire. I think you just get tired. This is all preparation. It's all the process. What's it for? He tells us. Because man is going to his eternal home, and the mourners go about in the street. They get ready for your funeral, as it were. You know, if you grasp this, you're going to feel pretty good. If you don't grasp this, you're going to go, oh, this is awful. Well, yeah, it's awful. Of course it is. I remember my mother one time, I called her and I said, so are you doing better? She said, you know, Freddie, called me Freddie. She said, don't ask me anymore if I'm doing better. I'm never getting better. Just ask me if I'm having a good day. And we laughed. Her spirits were pretty good that day. That's where we're headed. Are you there right now? Are you there right now? Then you should feel good. It's the day of your youth, and you should be rejoicing, right? These days are coming, though. They may last long, they may last short, but they're coming. He ends with, before the silver cord is snapped, the golden bowl's broken, the pitcher is shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern. And all that's talking about is light and water, and these are things that are symbolic of life. And so the light is dealt with, the broken bowl, you know, silver, golden bowl falls and breaks. Pitcher of water broken, the wheel, cistern to get the water up, done. You're tapped out. You're headed to your eternal home. The way he says it here is the dust returns to the earth as it was. The dust returns to the earth. And this goes back to Adam forming out of the dust of the earth, breathed life to him, and now spirit remove back to dust. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher. We want to remember him in the context of the relationship between our youth and our old age, right? Here's the second piece. You want to remember him beyond your well-being. You want to remember your Creator beyond your well-being. This is more putting the whole, it's in the text, but the whole book together, because it's been a book about well-being, and now Solomon is shifting to talk about your relationship with God. So you've been concerned about your well-being, how to do life and have well-being. That's great, but it's beyond that. There's something more. We're to remember our Creator beyond our well-being. And then that third piece is this. You want to remember him in fear and deeds, and that's where the text picks up, verse 13, the famous phrase, the end of the matter. All has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments. Fear God. He's the Creator, right? Respect, sure. But understand the nature of this God that you serve that made you, didn't have to make you, did. The end of the matter has been heard. Fear God, keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. And the flavor there in the language is it's the duty of all people. Everybody's going to give an account of some type to God. What he's describing here is for God's going to bring every deed into judgment, every secret thing, whether good or evil, good stuff, bad stuff, secret stuff, whatever. You got regrets? Congratulations. Moi too. You want less regrets? Wake up. Catch on. What does God want you to do that you haven't? I'm fond of a number of people in history. Some weren't exactly on our team. Some were sort of on our team. One of them was Marcus Aurelius. You know this guy? So in the Gladiator movie, Marcus Aurelius was the dad that Johnny Cash strangled, you remember? You have to see two movies to make sense of that. So Marcus Aurelius was an emperor, philosopher, king. He was the last of the five good emperors in Rome, as they say. And he and a guy named Epictetus figured out that it wasn't really what happens to us, but how we think about what happens to us that makes a difference. So they've been a big match inside of the history of Christianity. And they have other kind of weird things. Like they think marriage is between two people who are faithful to each other. And they do that because logically that's the only way it works. Marcus Aurelius said, "Do not act as if you are going to live 10,000 years. Death hangs over you. While you live, while it is in your power, be good." It's pretty good. Solomon. That's his point. Years ago, Kathy Bernal died and became famous in her death because, as the story goes, at Columbine, a gun was pointed at her and said, basically, "Do you believe in God?" And the answer was yes, and bang, you're dead. Some debate about whether that happened or how it happened, but seemed to be consistent that she was definitely praying loudly under the desk in that situation before she died. Michael W. Smith wrote a song, "This Is Your Time." It goes like this. "It was a test that we could all hope to pass, but none of us would want to take. Faced with the choice to deny God and live, for her there was one choice to make. This was her time. This was her dance. She lived every moment, left nothing to chance. She swam in the sea, she drank of the deep, embraced the mystery of all she could be. This was her time. Though you're mourning and grieving your loss, death died a long time ago, swallowed in life so that life carries on. Still, it's so hard to let go." It goes on. This is her time. Now, here's the trick. God may have something special for you. You may have a calling. But I promise you, if you do, he will tell you. If there's a call, because it's a call, you'll hear it. You'll have the chance to rebel against it. But a lot of this vain, mundane life under the living God who created us, who we're to fear and to keep his will, this God has already given us a whole lot to do. So this girl got to be martyred, or understood to be martyred, and yet the Bible gives as much credence to someone that offers a cup of water to someone in the name of Christ. Remember that? Matthew 25. So if you get busy doing the things that God's already said to do, all that mysterious stuff, I think he'll unfold to you. I know he will. If we aren't busy with the most basic things, y'all, why in the world would we expect that he unfolds something unique and special? He totally can do it, just like that. Ecclesiastes is this amazing book that tells us about how to live well in this world despite the game in a way that honors God and allows us to finish well. That's the challenge. So, again, what does God want you to do that you haven't? And I'd add, go do it. Lord, thank you for this moment, for the opportunity to pause and trust you. Even as we consider so many awesome things about eternity, what's ahead, you unfold that with the rest of the scriptures, and you made it so clear in time that Jesus Christ died, buried, raised again, and in this sacrifice of this Son, when we look with faith to him, he takes sin off of us, puts it on himself, takes his righteousness and puts it on us. In the midst of that promise and assurance, heaven's ours. There's a life beyond this one. We don't suffer as those with no hope. But instead, we can hope in you and be about what you have for us. And wow, in this church, what great opportunities lie just ahead. And in all we do, in serving kids or a cup in his name or maybe some more noticeable role, taking a few dollars and helping the poor or others, the way in which we sacrifice financially or with time or with words of kindness, or meeting urgent needs. All those things are the refreshing, living, incredible opportunity we have to be faithful until that day you call us to our eternal home. Pray for these saints in this moment, that you'd be honored in our giving, and that we would be honored in all that you've given us. In Christ's name and for his glory, we pray. Amen.